there's a new side. I printed something on the second side, so please avail yourself to the page that's on the table. Boker Tov, Boker Tov. Just looking ahead, Mitzvah Shem, next week we have a regular shiur. In 2 weeks, if you want to hear my shiur, you're going to have to fly down to Eilat, or walk down to Eilat, or, you know, some people take the bus to Eilat, whatever, but, you know, I don't do those things. Of course, we understand why it's called Eilat, because it's a lot of fun. So, but then this year is going to be in the evening at 5 o'clock on Tuesday and Wednesday.
Are you going based on the article in the paper today to help the problem? The mayor protest the young
one? I don't get involved in politics. No, man.
Not at all.
Politics. Hey. Yeah, I saw it. I saw the piece. Last week we began talking about some psychological insights in the, whether it was in the Gemara, some of the great Amoraim, some of the Rishonim, like the Rambam. Psychology became a discipline, a type of scientific discipline, which to a certain degree had to prove itself that it was indeed scientific. There were those who believed that science is an empirical science. That is to say, things can be measured, things can be duplicated, phenomena can be duplicated in a laboratory setting, and you can record and contrast all the results, and that's called science. That's exactly why evolution is not a science. It's a theory. The fact that it's taught in science departments, it's a little bit of what we call Geneva Da'at. The Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote about this in 1962, Tavshin Chabet, and he said at best it's speculative science. So there is a thing called speculative science, and that is, if let's assume you know that chemical will react at a certain temperature, and let's just say, for argument's sake, in centigrade, in the way we measure things here, at 20 degrees, and we observe how the same element reacts at 30, behaves at 30 degrees, then we can probably predict what's going to happen at 25 degrees, because you have the outer limits, and so on. But if you know how the element reacts at 20 degrees and at 30 degrees, and now I want to say, how is it going to react at 150 degrees? There's no real way to know that that's going to happen. Because if we're talking about, let's say, water, so we know that at 100 degrees it vaporizes, and at 0 degrees it freezes. So while it might still be the same H2O, two hydrogens and an oxygen, but the fact is that the temperature itself impacts on the movement of the molecules, and that expresses itself externally either as flowing water in the middle, frozen water on one side, and vapor on the other side. So there's no way for you to predict that. And that's why the Rebbe said that if you know what happens in planet Earth from, let's say, year 1 to year, you know, 5,788, fine. So maybe you could predict something inside those limits. But to go beyond those limits on either end, you're not really capable of making that assessment. You can make a prediction if you'd like. You can make an assessment. Bakasha.
Yeah, you said this now, and you said in a previous section that evolution is just speculation. There's a lot of hard science. I'm not saying it's proven. There's a lot of hard science that demonstrates many of the aspects of
that. That is correct. The Rebbe was talking about the issue of the age of the world, the age of the universe. And that's something which is a speculation because...
Okay.
There's a speculation. There's no question. If you look at the Ramban in Parshat Bereshit, he adopts an evolutionary understanding of the 6 days of Bereshit. How one leads to the other. I mean, he may not be familiar yet with genetic mutations and survival of the fittest and all this, but there's no doubt that there's a lot to this. Some have pointed out, I think the Rebbe even said this, that perhaps in a natural setting, they'll put God out of the picture, this could have developed in a million years, a billion years, whatever numbers you'd like to use, which are so astronomical. But when the Torah says, Vayomer Elohim, 10 times over, that means things shift in a very, very rapid way. in a way that I sometimes use the illustration between manual transmission and automatic transmission. So in the United States, they don't even know what manual transmission is anymore. But here in this country, some people still have a clutch and a stick shift. In manual transmission, you move from first gear to second gear to third gear to fourth gear. In automatic, you do nothing. You keep stepping on the gas, and you hope the transmission is still working and does it for you. So the Rebbe believed that Vayom Elokim is an intervention, that there is natural movement that might be evolutionary, except it would take a very, very long time. But the intervention of God at various stages caused, that was in a sense a catalyst and made things happen much, much quicker than what normally would have happened. So what the Rebbe simply does was, he doesn't prove unequivocally that the world was created exactly 5,788 years ago. What he does is, he puts a damper on what the scientists are saying. And he's saying, hold off, you know, it may not be 100% scientific, and as a speculative science, it has to be accepted as a speculation and nothing more than that. Psychology, so if you take up biology and chemistry and physics, these are pure sciences and these things are measurable. You can take the various forces of energy and the various and constellations and so on, that which is observable, that which you can see, that which you can bring into a laboratory and experiment with and record the data. So this is empirical science, no doubt. Psychology is problematic because human behavior is not so black and white that, you know, if somebody does this to you, you're automatically going to react. So if somebody gives you a punch in the arm, that doesn't automatically mean you're going to punch him back. Or it doesn't automatically mean you're not going to punch him back. There are many, many factors that govern human behavior. And therefore, it's suffered in the world of science for many years as being a pseudoscience, until things were quantified and were able to say, take a look at this. In all these cases, such and such behavior is a result of such and such stimuli. And now we can develop what's called, quote unquote, normal behavior. But you know, normal is a relative term, because in a mental hospital, what's normal might seem to us be very, very weird. But, you know, normalcy is relative to its surroundings. So that becomes another complicating part in psychology. And today, already over 100 years, almost 150 years from the beginning of study of psychology, whether Sigmund Freud and others, different branches of psychology have evolved, and some of them are even contradictory. You know, some are complementary. You know, you can have this and you can have that. So sometimes a therapist will listen to the story of a particular patient and realize that for this person we should take one route, and for another patient we should take a different route, where the two routes are based on very different concepts of human behavior. Sometimes behavioral abnormalities can be corrected with medication. Today we know that there could be, you know, chemical imbalances in a person that can cause behavioral problems. Fine, there could be genetic issues involved, which means somebody once pointed out to me that a red-headed Kayan has a low boiling point. He's the first one to explode in shul on something. So be careful if you have a red-headed Kayan. Now, is it proven historically, or is this just an impression that a few gabayim had in shul that they don't start up with a red-headed Kayan? But sometimes you find that you know the grandfather or grandparents, and you know the children, you know the grandchildren, and they just behave the same way. Now, I'll give you just an example. My family, so my father-in-law was a nice Frankfurt Jew, whereas in the Frankfurt community, there was one word that never made it into the lexicon. That was called change. It just never made it. They never heard of it. Just they never invented it in German. And then, of course, if it wasn't in German, never translated into English and never translated into life. So he would have been very comfortable in the Midbar eating man for 40 years and would never have complained about it. The only thing is, the rest of us down in the Midbar were Galatianas, and we wanted different food every day. and we remembered the good old delicacies of Mitzrayim. Zacharnu et adagash and nochal b'Mitzrayim chinam et hakishuim v'et avatichim. We had salatim. We had good things on the table. Ah, we had to work. Okay, fine, we had to work, but there was good something to eat. Here, what is this? It's nothing. There's no taste, no nothing to it. So some people are happy with that, and some people are not happy with that. Okay. Now, we came in Aliyah in 79, and one of my kids was in utero as we came on Aliyah. So while there was some contact on some level, a visit here, a visit there, with my in-laws throughout the years, this son has many, many of the character traits of my father-in-law. Now, it didn't come from me, that's for sure not. So how did that happen? Because these traits are sometimes genetic. Sometimes they're environmental. Society coins certain norms of behavior. But then it has to be environmental. There's a world of difference. Somebody growing up in the 1920s and 30s in Frankfurt, Germany, and somebody growing up in Elonshvut or in Beersheba in the 1980s. A world of a difference because it's a completely different social environment. Yet, there are going to be certain things about behavioral patterns that have to do with mood changes, mood swings, as we call them, and so on, that can indeed be genetic. So this has to be taken into consideration. Freud, of course, discussed the idea of the subconscious, that you think you're doing something because of a reality, but you made a decision because something you don't even think about. Something deep down is driving you to behave in a certain way. So the existence of the subconscious. So last week we showed in one of the sources, source number 5, that Chazal did recognize the existence of the subconscious. And I quoted Dr. Greenwald from Camp Corina on this one, who I heard this for the first time, where the Mishnah tells us, where the Breita tells us, that a person finds hears bad news that his father died, but that news also says that he just became a millionaire as a Yoresh. He inherits a lot of money, so he's obligated to say 2 brachot. One is Dayan HaEmet on the sad piece of news, and one is Atov HaMeitiv on the good news that he just won the jackpot and he's now a millionaire. So would that person, if you tell him, okay, now say the bracha because you're Sameach. He's not Sameach, he's not happy. He's ripping Kriya, he's sad, he's crying, and so on. Okay, so he'll deal with the fact later on when things subside that he just inherited a lot of money. But now I have to say the bracha, Tova Meitiv. And that's if he's going to share the Yerusha with others. If he's the only Yoresh, he has to make a Shechiyanu, which is astonishing that Chazal would make such a comment. So this Dr. Greenwald said that it's obvious that Chazal recognized the subconscious. The subconscious was very, very happy. So while it doesn't express itself externally, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So maybe Sigmund Freud once learned Mishnayot Baal Peh when he was a kid and recognized this in the sources, although as far as I know, he didn't quote the Mishnah. And he wasn't exactly a Belzer Chosid either. In the Shama Yehudit, let's say you have to move out the other chair. There you go. So this we talked about also. So these are different factors. And then there's another factor called the doctrine of free will. How does free will impact on behavioral patterns? Indeed, a person can have a certain pattern of life that usually his behavior fits the pattern, but at a particular juncture, for a particular dramatic reason, the person consciously shifts gears and does something against what might be construed as his normal behavioral pattern. The whole laws of tshuva are based on this. They're based on this, that a person cannot claim to God that, all right, what do you want from me? I have a pattern of behavior. It just happens to include about 16,000 affairs. That's all, but that's my pattern of behavior. So I'm not guilty. I'm not guilty. I've been pre-programmed to act in such a way. So that's halakhically inadmissible, because we believe that human beings do have the ability to think it out and to make a conscious decision that breaks the pattern of your particular behavior. And then it requires rebuilding of one's personality and so on. So that's why tshuva can be a very, very traumatic point in a person's life. And it can happen in one of two ways. It can happen instantaneously, you know, something really dramatic happens, and all of a sudden, the guy, man or woman, just says, I got to go along with God on this, and that's it. Or it's an evolvement. It just takes a long time. It starts slowly, builds up, and so on. And the halakha allows for individuality in terms of chazara b'tshuva. It never says, if you don't do tshuva in 24 hours, forget it. There's no such concept anywhere. Anywhere. So, you know, true, we have Yom Kippur, but we also have harotzeh b'tshuva, bracha we say three times a day in Shmoneh Esrei, which means there's a graduated tshuva. There's tshuva that spreads out. But the root of tshuva is the doctrine of free will. And that basically says that we can break, we are capable of breaking patterns. So that doesn't mean that because there's free will and we have the ability of breaking behavioral patterns, that behavioral patterns is nonsense. It's not nonsense at all. At all. The when one considers this week's parsha with regard to Paro, so the Ramban and the Rambam, both of them, deal with the issue how exactly can Paro be punished if God up front tells Avram Avinu in Parshat Lech Lecha, "V'gamet agoy asher yavodu dan anochi," and I'm going to get them back, you know, for all that what they've done to. If God already knows that the Paro is going to choose not to let Am Yisrael out, so where's the choice? Where's the free will? So this is discussed by both Ramban and Rambam, and they're invited to Ol Nechama for the shiur that I'm giving after davening this Shabbos, and I'll talk about it. So I'm not going to preempt now. It goes with a nice kiddush also. So, but I'd like to examine today some other streams in psychology that all bark up the behavioral psychology route. Before we get to that, just take a look at source number 8 on that first page, because I thought I was going to get to it last week and we didn't. And this has to do with clinical depression. You have to remember the Rambam in the 12th century was a kol boinik. He was jack of all trades. It's not like today where you specialize in a particular science, and in the science you specialize in certain category of the science and so on, to the exclusion of all others. And medicine, you know, so today, you know, you specialize in something, and the specialty have specialties, the specialties have more specialties, and so on. So you have to look for the person who specializes in the very, very specific thing today that you're looking at. But the Rambam was a believer in holistic medicine, which, by the way, some doctors are coming around to believing that this is extremely important. And really, to get the whole picture of the person and not just focus under microscopic examination a particular piece of body tissue and see what's wrong with it. But let's see everything that's going on in the person, and that can somehow give a clue to what triggered the onset of a disease. For example, we know that cancer, many people have a genetic disposition to certain cancers. It can be tested genetically. With young people, they know that they're carrying something that under certain circumstances can develop a certain cancer. So why may they, God forbid, develop it at age 75 instead of 35? We don't know why yet. But sometimes, at an early stage in life, it does show up, and they realize that something happened in the person's life, that it could have been a divorce, it could have been another calamity, it could have been something that triggered the mechanism for the cell duplication, to go a little haywire, and it causes cancerous tissues. So this is important today to know the whole picture, and I say parenthetically, no different than a Rav deciding or paskening a Shaila. A Rav that just listens carefully to the question at hand and has the Shulchan Aruch in hand and says it's mutar, it's permissible, or it's asur, it's forbidden, may be doing an injustice by not knowing the background of the person asking the Shaila. Because there can be other factors governing that particular question that the person who's asking the question may not be aware that they're even significant pieces of information, like one's economic standing. So, you know, it's very nice to say the chicken is treif. But one second, maybe this chicken is what's going to feed the family for 4 days. Whatever, I'm just giving an example. These things happened in Europe. And maybe it's treif because most of the poskim said it was treif in this particular shaila. But there are some who were lenient. Maybe in this particular case, you as a Rav have to extend the leniency because of the hefsed maruba, the loss that may be incurred by throwing out the chicken and so on. So that's why I'm against these shelot u'tshuvot on the WhatsApps and the internet. These rabbanim, they're just paskening online, you know, with flipping thumbs. And that's not how you decide a shayla. You have to know the person. You have to see really what's going on. And it's no different than in the world of medicine today. So the Rambam in source number 8, you can see that he has clinical psychology in mind. He himself suffered from clinical depression, by the way. In a letter written late in life, the Rambam talks about the fact that for a full year after his brother died, he drowned in the Indian Ocean. His brother was an international merchant. And his brother, older brother of the Rambam, personally supported the Rambam. He was interested in his younger brother, Moishele, should sit and learn and become the great Rambam that he became. And therefore, the Rambam did not have to bother spending time earning a livelihood. And when the brother died, the Rambam writes he was bedridden for a year. He couldn't get up. He was, you know, paralyzed. These are symptoms of depression. He just couldn't move. And finally, when he gets up, the community in Fustat, which is old Cairo, they wanted to offer him a salary for doing what he was doing for the community. But beforehand, he was doing it all gratis, and he refused to take money from the community for Melechet HaKodesh, for this kind of work. That's when he went into medicine professionally. He says, I'll be a doctor, and I'll make money. The Sultan will pay me a salary, that's all. But he's not going to take money from the community, but he'll continue the rigorous schedule that he had with the community anyway. So the Rambam knows all about clinical psychology. So here the Rambam tells us, depression in the language of Chazal was called marah shchora, like the bitter drop or something, the black drop, the bitter black. V'chein im hitora alav marah shchora, which means he was hit by depression. What does the Rambam recommend? He prescribes a in one word, chofesh, vacation. Get out of your normal routine and get a change of scenery. Why it is important to have chofesh? It is extremely important to have chofesh. Even great Rabbanim took chofesh. Well, Rav Moshe Feinstein Zal took chofesh, so he went up to the Catskill Mountains. What do you think? He sat there and played paddleball. I mean, he brought Sfarim. He didn't have all Sfarim, and we know that because he wrote, you know, responsum. He wrote the tshuvas there, and he apologized. I don't have all my Sfarim here. I'm just quoting out of memory. Beseda. But he was busy. He was busy answering questions and so on. But he was able to sit on the porch of a bungalow, which he called bungalow, and because he didn't know the word bikta, and you know, without his kapota, just with his shirt and tzitzis, and it was nice air blowing in. He knew this was important for him. It was as it's important for others. He would take a walk with the rabbitson, you know, nice, a chofesh, chofesh. Very important. Everybody understands that today. Even communist Russia, atheists, they understood that chofesh is important. The ones who didn't understand it was important were the Nazis, Yimach Shimon, to give a person a break. There was no break in the concentration camps. Just like in Paro, in Mitzrayim. The Rambam tells us that the reason why Am Yisrael receives a concept of Shabbat right after Yetziat Mitzrayim, this is before they even get to Har Sinai, after the Yam Suf, it says, Al Yetzei Ishmim Komo B'Yom Shvi'i, the month's going to fall 6 days a week, seventh day it won't work, it won't fall. One day a week, you don't leave your house. Don't go to work, as if to say. There's a concept of Shabbat already introduced at the beginning. And the Rambam explains in the Guide to the Perplexed, the Moreh Nevuchim, because this was a rectification of a social injustice. They didn't give us a day off. So a day off is important. So here the Rambam says, you might need a few days off. Yasira b'shmi'at shirim u'minei niginot. You can remove the depression by engaging in listening to poetry and all kinds of melodies, or translated, go to a concert. Go to a concert, listen to some tapes. I was going to say records, but maybe this crowd still remembers what records are. I'd never say records to a classroom anymore. They don't know what I'm talking about. Because, you know, Taklitim, that's in the Museum of Natural History, right next to the dinosaur exhibit. Ubetiyul beginot, take a trip to nice gardens, and ubebinyanim na'im, see nice houses. You know, appreciate the aesthetics and beauty of the surroundings, and it's not your surroundings. Go to somewhere else. Ubeyishiva im tzurot na'ot, with nice forms, figures. This is an art museum. Go to an art museum. Ukiyotze bazeh mimashi archiv hanefesh. you'll feel good about this. Just do it a few times over, and you know it should work. Now, if this is not a serious episode of depression, this should do the trick. Obviously, Rambam doesn't know from Prozac. He doesn't know from different, more extreme measures, because Rambam would not have a clue how to deal with somebody who, after taking such a vacation, is still depressed because the person has, let's say, some chemical imbalance that's causing the depression. Don't think for a moment that this is bitul Torah, a waste of time. No, no, no. But have in mind that you're doing this so that you should be healthy. The purpose, the ultimate purpose of healthy body is there should be a healthy mind. So somebody's going to say, no, this is Aristotle. But just because Aristotle said something right, also, doesn't mean the Rambam stole it from Aristotle. He believed it was true. That in order to have a functioning mind, you do have to deal with your physical self and make sure that you're healthy. You don't have to worry about pains and krachsim and so on. And once those are attended to, your mind is going to be free to deal with in more lofty and important manners. But you see, the Rambam addresses the issue 850 years ago, I may add, of a clinical depression in a very, very modern way. I'm sure you've heard of art therapy and music therapy. That's what he's talking about. It's exactly what he's talking about here. Okay, now we just move to source number 9. And here opens up a whole subject that I hope I'll be able to do justice today. And if not, we're just going to have to continue this next week because this is really an important subject. And that is source number 9. Let's read it inside first, and then you'll see where I'm going with this. Gufa is just a technical term in the Gemara where a certain issue was raised in the context of a Talmudic discussion, a sugya, and then the Gemara wants to lift it out of context. We call cut and paste in the computer language, and let's subject it to microscopic examination. Let's just deal with these two lines, out of context of how it fell into the Gemara. So that's what gufa means. You know, let's just take this part. So it's a technical word. Chatzi shiur. What does chatzi shiur mean? We know that a person to either perform a mitzvah or aveira that has to do with eating, there's a minimum quantitative amount that you have to intake or ingest in order to either fulfill the mitzvah or violate an avera. Matzah on the Seder night, you have to eat a kezayit's worth, an olive's worth. So, of course, the question is, how do you measure an olive's worth? It's very nice to know it's a kezayit. This is, I can tell you that my great-grandfather from the town of Pilsno in Galicia, a kezayit matzah on Seder night meant to eat a little bit of matzah. That's what it meant. Nobody in Galicia sat with charts and to measure out the broken matzah that he or she is eating a kezayit. Nobody. But in Lithuania, things happened somewhat differently. And the classic understanding of a kezayit was a half an egg, the volume of displacement of water, which means you take a cup of water and you fill it up to its rim. You take an egg, you put it in, and you let the water overflow. Take half that amount of what overflowed, that's the volume of a kezayit. That's how it is. Now, it's not a large amount, by the way. It's not a large amount at all. And if you translate it into a machine square matzah, it's a third of a matzah. Now, I know that your grandchildren would think that if you were eating a third of a matzah on Seder night, you would never yotze your mitzvah of matzah. But I got news for you, that's what a kezayit is. What was the problem? It was the Neidah Behuda, Rabbi Cheskel Levi Landau, the Rebbe of Prague, of over 250 years ago, who suggested that things in nature have changed and that the eggs used to be much larger and hence twice as large, as a matter of fact, and therefore the sheer kezayit really has to be doubled. So whatever you thought was a kezayit, do times two. It's twice that amount. Now, in Prague, where he was the Rav, nobody took him seriously there. I'm not even sure that the Rebbe Yehuda himself, you know, was machmer on that level. And that became a view, a shita, an idea that sat around the Batei Midrash for almost 250 years unnoticed. Some people knew that he said it, but from saying it to translating it, as they say, bashetach, you know, that people are going to do this, it's two different things. Till the Chazon Ish came around. Chazon Ish dies in 1953 in Bnei Brak. And Chazon Ish adopted this viewpoint of the Noid Yehuda. Now, what's happened, and this is a general story, of the dynamics of Chumrah. We live in the age of Chumrah, in case you haven't figured it out yet. So, that view of the Chazon Ish then becomes more and more accepted in mainstream halachic opinion. So, in mainstream yeshiva opinion. So the yeshiva boys are now hearing that the kezayit is twice as much as what their parents and grandparents ever thought it was, and they're coming home with new shiurim. And then, of course, the designers have put together, you know, pages with squares and rectangles and whatnot, so you can just place your matzah on there, and you know that, yeah, this is now the new kezayit matzah, two-thirds of a matzah. But by the way, there's a chumrah that when you eat matzah, the first bar bracha, you should have a kezayit for the mitzi and a kezayit for the matzah. So that's two times kezayit of the double kezayit. So that's already a matzah and a third for just for the bracha. You didn't even get the kairich yet. So this is, you know, the inflation of the shear of kezayit, which is basically happening. We're aware of that. The chatzi shi'ur means, it doesn't mean half the amount, it means anything less than the whole. And I'll give you two examples where chatzi doesn't mean half, 50%. Chatzi kaddish. Chatzi kaddish doesn't mean 50% of kaddish. It means it's not the complete kaddish. When we say kaddish shalem, we mean kaddish with tidkabel tzolotahon, yesh lamaraba, oseh shalom bim romav. That's the complete kaddish. But if it's abbreviated, or a more fancy word, truncated, it's chatzi kaddish. Nobody sat and counted the words to see that until damyan bi'almav imru amein, before musaf on Shabbat, that's 50% of the words of until you get to oseh shalom b'rumamav yaseh shalom alein makoy shalomein. I'm not interested in how many words. It's called chatzi kaddish because it's less than the whole. Or, better yet, chatzi halil on Rosh Chodesh. So what you don't do is, you don't say half of two chapters of the Tehillim that we're saying in the Hallel. But if you look at it, you see that 90% of Hallel we say on Rosh Chodesh and on the remaining days of Pesach, except for the first day. And we call it Chatzi Hallel. Chatzi means less than the whole. So Chatzi Shir means less than a Kazayit. It could be 1%, it could be 99%, and everything in between. That's called Chatzi Shir. So let's assume you have a mitzvah of matzah, or you have an Aveira, like eating Besar Chazir, you're not allowed to eat pork, or you're not allowed to eat a cooked product, the Basar B'Cholav. All of these foods is measured by a Kazayit. But all you did was ate less than a Kazayit. Is that an Aveira or not? That's a legitimate question. If the Torah says it has to be a Kazayit, and I ate half a Kazayit's worth of matzah, did I fulfill the mitzvah? But we're talking now about the Aveirot. Those Aveirot that have a quantitative value, whatever the quantitative value is, I'm using it as an example, Kizayit. So the Gemara says, Chatzi Shi'ur, it's Machloket. Rabbi Yochanan Omar, Asur Min HaTorah, that even less than a Shi'ur of, let's say, Besar Chazir, is also forbidden in the Torah. One second. So why do I have to know about a Shi'ur? If more than a kezayit is asur, and less than a kezayit is asur, so even a minuscule of besar chazir is asur, so who cares about kezayit? The answer is, that's to do with the punishment in Beit Din. When Beit Din was giving punishments, and for eating besar chazir in the presence of two witnesses, you'd be liable to malkot, so malkot would only be given, administered, if a person ate a shi'ur's worth, a kezayit's worth of the besar chazir. But it doesn't mean if you ate less than that, he did a mitzvah. It's still an Aveira. It's a biblical Aveira. Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish is, it's the way how it came out, you should know that. We call him Reish Lakish. It's Reish with a Gershayim Shin. It's Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. So what happened in manuscripts is that the Gershayim, you know, started, the copyist started writing it as a Yud. So it became Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish. But there's a street in the neighborhood in Katamon, the Reish Lakish. Near the Katamonim. So Rav Shimon ben Lakish amar, mutar min haTorah. That min haTorah, you're allowed to eat less than a kezayit's worth of forbidden foods. Rav Yochanan amar, asur min haTorah. Why is it asur? Kevan dechazir le'itztarufei, isura ka'achil. Because when you eat a third of a kezayit of something forbidden, and that's all you plan to eat because you're such a Talmud Chacham, and you know that if I just eat less than a kezayit, God's not going to hold me liable. Your taste buds are going to get the better of you, and you're going to nibble a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more. I don't know exactly what the Gemara is talking about. Just put a loaf of cake in front of me with a knife. A little bit, just a little bit. Just a little bit, a little bit, a little bit. Before you know it, 3/4 of the cake is gone, right? But you only ate a little bit, right? Every 3 minutes, you ate a little bit. This happens to all of us, okay? So you don't have to feel bad if it happens. It happens to me, it happens to you. Meseda. Chazi le'itztarufe. It's mitztaref, which means it adds up. It's cumulative. That's what chazi le'itztarufe means. It's cumulative. You ate a third of besar chazir, or you ate a cheeseburger where the meat was kosher and the cheese was kosher. Because that's when the biblical Isur kicks in. The meat has to be kosher and the cheese is in. And you made a cheeseburger and you ate, I just want to know how it tastes. That's all, just a little taste. You know, not bad. So you take a little bit more, a little bit more, a little more. And before you know it, you've stumbled over the line of the kezayit almost without knowing. And this is what Rabbi Yochanan was worried about. Kivan the chazi litzdarufe, isura ka'achil. The first bite that may not have been measured by a kezayit ultimately adds up to the bona fide biblical prohibition, because havdil in a basketball game. So if a team gets 100 points, the first two baskets were also important. Somehow or another, the game becomes dramatic at the end. But no less important are the first 2 and 4 points. They're very important because it adds up. So too, it adds up. So ultimately, that which you ate before you ate the whole kezayit was going to be part of the biblical isur, and therefore Rabbi Yochanan said it's really prohibited. Reish Lakish says, why is it mutar min haTorah? Achila ara amar rachmana. Rachmana is a rabbinic term in the Gemara, meaning the Torah. The Torah says it has to be an act of eating, the lekka. Anything less than a minimum quantitative shiur measurement is not considered an act of eating from the point of view of the Torah. So if you ate less than a kezayit, it's not that you considered eating, and therefore the Torah cannot prohibit it. So it's mutar min haTorah. But I'd like to focus on chazi le'itztarufe. Chazi le'itztarufe, and it just so happens that even according to Reish Lakish, there might be a rabbinic prohibition, but that's not what the Gemara is discussing now. Might be a rabbinic prohibition anyway, not to eat less than a kezayit, for the same reason that now it's rabbinic, and you think you're okay, but you know it's going to add up, and you're going to fall into the biblical zone of prohibition. Let's take a look against the background of this, source number 10 from the Sefer Chinuch. Sefer Chinuch in Mitzvah Ayin Gimel, the bottom of the first page, Sefer Chinuch in Mitzvah Ayin Gimel tells us that this is the Avera from Parshat Mishpatim, not to eat treif meat. Now, we use the word treif in our Yiddish English, /English, meaning non-kosher. But the word treifa is a specific type of prohibited meat. There is nevela, and nevela means a carcass. The behema died, the animal just died. That's called a nevela. That's one prohibition. And another prohibition is treifa, where the animal was devoured, or translated halachically, slaughtered not accordance with halacha. The shechita was psula. The shechita was disqualified, and that's called treifa. So ultimately, the Torah says, "Uvasar basadet treifa lo tochelu lakelef tashlichunato." That the Torah uses just an image of reality, an animal that was devoured by a ferocious animal, let's say a lamb that was devoured by a ferocious animal, so you're not allowed to eat the meat of that lamb, that might be salvageable because it's a trefa. That's where it all comes from. But it's translated halachically that even if no ferocious animal was in sight, all it was the sheikhet with his knife, and he didn't do a good job, and the shechita was, the slaughtering process became disqualified for a zillion reasons, so that behema is also called a trefa. A trefa is also an animal that has an internal blemish, wound, some imperfection, that won't allow the animal to live for 12 months. Now, how in the world are you going to know that? Well, of course, before you do shechita, you have to subject the animal to a CT and to a
MRI.
An MRI, and whole body, full body MRI.
You have to wait 12 months to get an appointment.
Right, you have to wait 12 months to get an appointment anyway. Shkoyah, very good. Right? So this is the whole question. So how can we drink milk from a cow? How can you, the cow's kosher. But how do you know that the cow that this milk in the container comes from wasn't a trefa? You don't know the payment is a trefa. When you milk the cow, the cow looked pretty healthy to me. You don't know what's going to be 12 months down the road, if there's any internal blemish. When do you know if there's internal blemish? Right after the shechita, right after the slaughtering, the shochet is also a bodek. That's why his title is Shuv, Shin Vav Bet, Shochet U Bodek. He checks immediately the lung, because the lung, if the animal grazed on the field, and not only does it pick up grass and whatever else it's picking up, but it might pick up a rusty nail and cause a perforation in the lung. Why? Because like little babies, we don't give kids up to 3, 4, 5 years old, you know, peanuts, because the closure of the esophagus and the trachea is not well developed yet. And you can have a peanut going down the trachea and the baby, God forbid, or the child can choke and die. And these things have unfortunately happened. You have to be careful about this. So, but ultimately, a child in his development develops that the trachea shuts tight when you eat and the esophagus shuts tight when you breathe. And that's an unbelievable mechanism that the good Lord instilled. And when it doesn't work, we're in trouble. Sometimes, you know, you're eating, and food goes down the wrong tube. That's going to happen. Why? Because you were talking. You're talking, so the trachea is opened. You lend yourself to choking. That's what happens. So an animal does not have that development stage. So when it eats, the esophagus is open, trachea is open. So it is possible that something, sharp object, even a piece of glass, might get into the lung and cause a perforation, cause a hole. And that's a trefa. That's a trefa. So it could be that it was not a major damage, and the animal healed itself. But like other, you know, wounds, it causes scar tissue, and scar tissue on the outer membrane is called in Hebrew a sircha. So the lung membrane is very, very smooth, and all the sheikhan has to do is stick his hand around the lung and just feel for bumps. If there are no bumps, that behema is called glat. And what's glat mean? Smooth. That's what it, glat. Glat kosher, you know? Like glat kosher eggs and cheese restaurants, which have no business being called glat. Glat means that the lung for sure was never perforated because there was no adhesions, no sircha on the lung. If there is a bump, then the sheikha takes the lung out for inspection. And he does exactly what we do when we look for a hole in a tire, for a look of a flat tire, the panchamacha. You blow it up with air, you put it in a pail of water, and you look for bubbles. If there are bubbles, air bubbles coming out, it's a trefa. It means there's a perforation. If there's no air bubbles whatsoever, the Rav will say it's kosher. That the animal is kosher. There was a thing in Europe many years ago, a certain super duper tzaddikim didn't want to eat meat that already a shayla was asked. There's a phrase in Yiddish, mefrekta shayla shon treif. If you ask a shayla, it's already, you know, treif. But the honest truth is, most people ate. If the Rav said it was kosher, that was okay. There was one community in Europe that the community took upon itself this chumrah, and that was the Hungarian Jewish community. And when the Hungarian Jewish community migrated to the United States in 1956, the United States Orthodox community first heard of glat kosher. First heard of glat kosher. And now, everything's glat kosher. There's no such thing as regular kosher anymore, which means there's no such thing as glat kosher anymore. Because the Rav told me back in 1976 that certain shechita houses were already passing off meat as glatt, even if it had three adhesions. Forget about one. The glatt consumer has grown so that the meat industry cannot provide enough glatt, so they simply eroded the definition of glatt. So it's very sad, very, very sad, that there's a type of gneva dat going on. Then, of course, everything else became glatt. You know, glatt chickens. If a chicken has even one sircha, it's no longer a shayla, it's treif. So therefore, every kosher chicken, by definition, is glatt. So don't tell me it's glatt. Every kosher chicken, by definition, must necessarily be a smooth lunk. Cannot have any adhesions whatsoever. And then it moved over to dairy restaurants. That means the cheese was glatt, I don't know. And the eggs are glatt. And I once had a maisa in New York, before my parents came in Aliyah. So I had a great trick. Whenever I need a new suit, I would always come to visit New York, get off the plane with some schmatas on, and my mother would always send me to this store in Flatbush, you know, and buy a new suit. Okay, it always worked. It always worked. So I go to this store. A nice Jewish woman owned the store, but there was an Indian fellow who was the salesperson. So he takes out a suit for me. I tell him the size, and he tells me it's glatt. I looked at him. I honestly didn't know what he was telling me, because I thought the word in Hebrew, glatt, is chalak. You know that. We say basa chalak. Chalak is found in Parshat Toldot, which is my Bar Mitzvah Parsha, where Yaakov Avinu was worried that after Rivka put on the skins to make him look, disguise him as Esav, ulay yimusheni avi, he is chalak. He himself is very smooth. Esav is very hairy. So I thought the guy was telling me it's a very smooth wool. He tells me it's chalak. No! He was telling me that these suits already underwent shatnas testing before they came into the store. I didn't know that. In my days, they didn't do these things. So became a glatt suit. Okay. So now you know the word glatt has taken off to all different directions. So this is a treif. I just want to say one humoristic note on Vasar Basader Treifa Lo Tochelu Lakelef Tashlichunato. So the Medrash says, why say give it to the dogs? What the Torah is really saying is that treif meat, you're allowed to derive monetary or financial benefit from. You're allowed to make money off the treif meat. You're just not allowed to eat it. But there's no Isur Hana'ah. The question is, why did it say give it to the dog? So this goes back to Yetziat Mitzrayim, that the Torah says, Lo yecharatz kelev lishano. The dogs didn't bark when Am Yisrael left Mitzrayim, and therefore nobody was petrified, nobody was scared, so the dogs deserved the treif meat. Okay, that's a medrash, by the way, that's a medrash. But the story goes that 150 years ago in Poland, so there was a lot of people lived in out the rural areas, and they didn't have phones or anything like that. And as my follower Shalom once said, we never had klita problems in Pilsner, right? We certainly did not. So this man comes to town twice a year, and he speaks to his Rav, and he says, I have shaylus on my meat, and I don't know how to get in touch with a Rav. I'm far away. I only come twice a year. So the Rav says very simple. It says, Uvasar basadet refa lo tochelu lakelef tashlichunoto. Every time you have a shayla, put the meat next to the dog. If the dog eats the meat, you know it's treif. If the dog doesn't eat the meat, you know it's kosher. Wonderful. Guy comes back 6 months later. He says, Rav, maybe you have a different eitzah, a different idea. What's wrong with the first idea? Excellent idea, but the dog is such a machmer. He did everything. Right. Okay, so what does the Sefer Chinuch say about treifa in source number 10? The Sefer Chinuch adopts a position that both the Rambam and the Ramban entertain, and that is that whatever the Torah forbade as forbidden foods are also injurious to our health. They're not healthy. They're not healthy. Now, some of this we even know today to be scientifically true. Like pork meat, there's a bacterial disease called trichinosis. The person does not eat pork meat, zero chance they'll ever get it. Okay. Does that mean that's the reason why the Torah forbade it? Not necessarily. Like what came first, the chicken or the egg? So once there's a prohibition, we know that a Kadosh Baruch Hu wants, and the Sefer Chinuch elaborates on this, wants that we should have good food, healthy food, tasty food, and so on, and certainly not unhealthy food. So he says that when an animal has been injured, So he has already, this is 13th century Barcelona speaking. 13th century Barcelona says there's already decomposition, deterioration in the animal tissue, which makes the meat fundamentally unhealthy. It spoils. It's going to spoil. It's going to sickly, it's a sickly animal. The meat's not going to be healthy. So he asks the question, let's assume the behemoth is slaughtered. The behemoth was 100% healthy. And is slaughtered it right now. And it was imperfect, shechita. And we ruled that it's a treifa. What's the statistical probability that right now the meat is not healthy? That takes time. If the behemoth was sick and was walking around with something that we didn't know, so that we can understand that the meat is not going to be healthy. But here it was a healthy animal. It's just that there was a technical knockout. The shechita was imperfect. So you want to say that the meat now is already not healthy? This came up, by the way, 1936. In the aftermath of the Nuremberg laws, that the Nazis, you know, they were very worried, very, very worried about Tsar Balei Chayim, about cruelty to animals. They couldn't care about cruelty to human beings, but cruelty to animals, and they forbade Shechita. They forbade Shechita, which, by the way, carries, till this very day in Switzerland, and there are other countries in Europe where there's no Shechita, because it's cruelty to animals. So the Nazis said they can only do Shechita, you know, slaughter animals, because, you know, Germans ate meat. If the animal was pre-stunned with an electric shock, you give an electric shock to the brain, and then you can, you know, kill the animal. Because then the animal has lost consciousness because of the electric stunning, and so on. So it was Rav Weinberg, the Sri Deish, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who writes a whole tshuva, maybe suggesting that if the shechita is done a moment after the stunning, the behemoth is still considered alive enough to halachically permit the shechita. And why did he say that? Because he wanted to save the day and allow people still to be able to have fresh meat in Germany. And all of the Rabbanim, I mean all, and specifically the great Gedolim of Lita, came down on him hard, and he retracted. He just couldn't get anywhere with that heter. But what's the problem? The minute you stun the animal and it loses consciousness, you have damaged the brain. And therefore, when you do the shechita, the behema is already a treifa. So Sefer Chinuch writes, the al tekshe alacha v'tomar, don't ask the question, ma hefsed efshar liyot b'behema shenitrafa miyad v'nishchata. How much damage is going to be in the meat of the animal if it becomes a treifa and immediately afterwards it's slaughtered, like the case of electric stunning? That's not a smart question, says the author of Sefer Chinuch. He's writing this whole book to his son, by the way. Everything has a beginning. So if you agree with me that eventually the meat of the animal is going to deteriorate because of the blemish that has been incurred, so on a minute level it already started. Im toda elai ki ba'ofen hazman yimatzei ha'efsed ba mechamat ha'tarfut. If you agree that with time the quality of the meat will seriously deteriorate and become unhealthy, titchayev lehodot, you will be forced, obliged to admit to me ki berega rishon hutchal ha'efsed, that doesn't start 5 years later, 5 hours later, 5 minutes later, but it is immediate. It begins. The other thing is, it's not measurable. It's too small to measure. Ela shehu mu'at b'hatchala, very small. Ve'ein safek ki min ha'nezek ra afilu miyuto. Even small, minuscule damage is damage. Ve'od, and furthermore, shekol dinei Torah v'chol sheyesh b'la kayama, everything that's permanent in the Torah, begeder kazeh yitchayev liyot. It has to be some type of a standard. She'im titein dvarecha l'shiurim lo yitkayem davar b'yadecha l'olam. If we're going to allow people to make their own judgment on whether the animal is still healthy or unhealthy, we'll never get out of this. There's got to be a standard that's going to apply to every animal, and therefore the behemah becomes treif. The moment it becomes treif, there's no heter. Yeah,
what was the answer to the cow's milk?
Okay, so the problem with the cow's milk was that we never really know if the behemah would eventually be a treifa. So there's a principle in Masechet Chulin called Rov Behemot Ksherot. The majority of behemot are kosher, are healthy and kosher. And therefore, we simply say that even if, you know, by some way, milk got mixed into its bottle b'shishim, because you certainly have more than 60 parts, kosher milk, then mixed in with some small quantities of perhaps non-kosher milk. The whole thing's a suffix. The whole thing's a big suffix. And that's why we matter. That's why we drink. And by the way, the Rav told me that Rov behemot in society, in the world are not glut. In other words, if we would do shechita on rov of the behemot in the world, we would discover that you don't have a majority without adhesions to the lung. Which he said was a proof, this to him was a proof, that glut was not the standard. You're going to have people out there saying that glut is the standard of kashrut, and anything less than that is treif. But it's wrong, because the Gemara says rov behemot ksherot. And if rov behemot ksherot and rov behemot are not glut, that shows, and the halacha works with this rov. You drink milk and milk products and so on. The halacha functions with this rov. Rov means majority. It's a statistical majority. That's all. Statistical information, the majority, it's not, won't be treif, and therefore you can drink the milk. That's the answer. Now, this all leads to, we just have a few minutes and we're going to get to the second side next week in Mitzvah Hashem, to a whole discussion about behavior. About behavior. And next week, the beginning of this year, I'm going to give you an overview on behavioral psychology, so we'll understand several very, very important ideas, including what's behind Chazi Litzdarufe, the cumulative effect, and what Chazal call Lo Plug, the no exception rule. Lo Plug means that you can have a scenario where Chachamim said, you can't do such and such because of. But now I have a particular case where the because of is not relevant. Can I do it or not do it? I'll give a good example. Playing a musical instrument. So there's no biblical violation in taking out a guitar and playing on Shabbat. What's the violation? Violation is gzeirah shema yitaken kli. Tikkun kli, fixing a vessel, is part of construction. Construction is one of the 39 principal malachot, and fixing a vessel is like part of that. It's in the same family. And tuning an instrument is called fixing a vessel. If I take out the guitar and I see it's out of tune, I have to tune it. So it's the tuning of it that's going to be a problem. Now, of course, you may say, do you tune it every time you take it out? No. But sometimes you do. Sometimes you do. But what about instruments that you don't tune? There's certain wind instruments. There's no tuning. It's not a string instrument that have to constantly tune. And let's say a piano that can be tuned and should be tuned once every 100 years. Every time you sit down to the piano, you don't tune it. It's pretty much in tune. So the answer is lo plug, no exception rule. But the moment Chazal said no musical instruments on Shabbat, so it covers even those instruments where the rationale for the prohibition does not even exist. That's very, very important. Lo plug. It's the no exception rule. So let's assume you know that there's a law in the country, and the law of the country is din, dina de malchuta dina. The law of the country is you have to observe according to halacha. So there's a red light, traffic lights, and you're not allowed to cross on traffic a red light. And you understand that, and it's a major thoroughfare, and certainly you don't want to commit suicide here. And you wait for the green light. The other thing is that now it's it's 3 in the morning, or maybe even on a Shabbat, and you're walking, and there are hardly any cars, if not at all. You look both ways, it's an empty road, it's a red light. Are you allowed to cross on the red light?
No.
Legally, for sure not. For sure not. But also educationally, for sure not. Why? Because the minute you break ranks and say, rationalize, well, now there are no cars coming. It's only one step away to say, there are cars coming, but they're far away. And that's not far from saying, there are cars coming, and they're close, but they're not driving that fast, and I can make it to the other side. And that's not far from saying, zoosh! And the next thing you know, you're dead, right? Or you do what you practice this kind of behavior, and some 10-year-old kid standing next to you was told by his parents, you don't cross on the red, and this guy crosses on the red because there's nobody coming, and he turns around, he tells the kid, Freier Rata, you're a friar, wait, no car's coming. And the kid crosses. The kid has broken the ice. You see, you can cross on red, and the world didn't collapse. Do you remember the story of Milchemet Amalek? Asher Karcha Baderech. Rashi says, after Yetziat Mitzrayim, everything was sizzling. Everybody knew the news. There was CNN taking pictures of Yetziat Mitzrayim. It says, Az nifhalu alufei Edom, Elei Moav, Yochazei Moraad, Nomogu kol Yoshvei Kenan. They all got the news. Plishtim, Moav. They all heard the news. And it was sizzling. Nobody was going to touch Am Yisrael after Yetziat Mitzrayim. Comes Amalek, Asher Karcha Baderech, from the word kar, cold. They cool down the sizzling bathtub. You know, there's a boiling, I once saw this once, by the way, boiling hot mikveh. Nobody wants to go in. One Meshigana goes in first, and now everybody goes in. You see, you know, it's doable. That's what Amalek did. They paved the way for others to attack us. And they showed that Am Yisrael is not invincible. That's all. You can hit. And we were hurt. Torah doesn't give us details of casualties, but we were hurt. It says when the hands of Moshe went down, v'gavar Amalek, and Amalek was being victorious at those moments. What does that mean? It was killings and woundings and so on. That's what it means. So they allowed other countries to realize, B'nai Yisrael, you can start up with B'nai Yisrael. They cooled it off for us. And this can happen in certain modes of behavior. Modes of behavior. And the question is, where does education come in and consistency of education come in and lo plug, no exception rule come in? Not to damage and undermine chinuch of parents, of schools, and so on, and society at large. So this we'll deal with Mitzshem next week. Yeah, Baksha.
Many years ago, a senator from New York coined an expression, defining deviance down. And what he meant by that is what you're talking about, but on a macro level.
Okay.
The individual, on the societal level,
right.
The cultural level.
Okay, Beseda. Okay, so please show up next week, and we have some interesting things to finish up here.